Alligator Alcatraz's first occupants speak out, and so does the mayor. 500,000 Haitians face return to Haiti, and Key West defies, then obeys Governor DeSantis. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk with the reporters who've heard from the first inmates at Florida's controversial new migrant detention center out in the Everglades, Alligator Alcatraz, a place Miami-Dade County's mayor says is not who we are. We'll also discuss how Haitians and other migrants here are coping with President Trump's efforts to strip them of their deportation protections, and we'll look at why Key West did a 180 on partnering with the feds on immigration. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. This week, in a letter to Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava demanded monitoring access at the new and controversial migrant detention center out in the Everglades known as Alligator Alcatraz. In a Miami Herald op-ed titled, "Alligator Alcatraz is Not Who We Are," Levine-Cava expressed serious concerns about potential environmental damage the facility will cause and the potentially inhumane living conditions for its up to 5,000 inmates. Journalists are hearing early reports from those detainees and their families about the situation inside the hastily constructed tent structure, and they do raise concerns. Toilets that don't flush, jungle-like heat, and jungle-like insects. At least one occupant rushed to the hospital. Meanwhile, state officials deny any serious problems at Alligator Alcatraz, and Governor Ron DeSantis is holding it up as a marquee showcase of Florida's partnership with President Trump's sweeping migrant deportation campaign. Joining me now to discuss this not unexpected scrutiny Alligator Alcatraz is under are Ana Ceballos, politics and policy reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, and CBS4 Miami reporter Yvonne Taylor. Welcome to you both.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
We'd also like to hear your thoughts on the Alligator Alcatraz controversy. Do you perhaps know someone detained there? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Ana Ceballos, we know that migrant detainees started arriving at Alligator Alcatraz last week. How many are there now, and what were some of them telling you and your Herald colleagues this week, at least through their spouses, about the conditions they found there, in particular for that detainee who had to be rushed to a hospital in Kendall?
Sure. So detainees have been arriving at this detention facility in the Everglades. They started coming in on July 2nd. And right. So the state hasn't really provided much information about exactly. We don't really have an official confirmation, right, of how many detainees are in there. But estimates from what we've heard from detainees and from sourcing is that it's in the hundreds. Uh-huh. There is a lot of information coming in from there through family members. So it's all, you know, detainees have the right to make calls. But so we're hearing like a patchwork of kind of anecdotes based on their own experiences. And some of the things we're hearing that are matching up between all of these accounts is that there's been pretty in the early days from the moment that this detention facility opened, there were like some issues with water. For example, there were some toilets that weren't really flushing or they were overflowing. Right. There was really little or no access to showers. There's people who got there on, for example, on July 3rd and they hadn't showered until this week. So about like 4 days they went without showering and they kept asking. They were also not giving any toothbrushes, or at least didn't know where to find the toothbrushes. And there's been a lot of concern as well about how detainees don't really have access to confidential calls with attorneys, or mm-hmm. that there's no process for how to request a visitation.
And that one detainee who took ill had to be rushed to Kendall, to a hospital in Kendall, right? That's quite a drive from out in the Everglades to the interior of Miami, no?
Right. So there was a lot of stories, again, coming from the detention facility about a medical emergency. And we reached out to the state after we heard from several detainees and as well as an eyewitness who saw the ambulance with lights on heading east toward Miami. And the state pretty much said that it was fake news, that there was no medical emergency, but
Okay.
then the hospital confirmed that there had been a detainee from Alligator Alcatraz
Okay.
getting care at the hospital, and the Department of Homeland Security eventually confirmed that someone did get treatment there but was returned to the facility.
Okay. And Anna, have you been able to get a sense of whether the detainees who were communicating with you have criminal histories or not? Because again, according to President Trump, this is supposed to be about holding criminal undocumented migrants for deportation, right?
Right. I mean, again, it's a little bit it's difficult to discern like the huge sample. We're talking about hundreds of detainees. We've only talked to a small sample of people, and the people that we did talk to, they had been arrested for traffic violations. There was another person who was arrested after an ex reported him for a verbal altercation. So it was like a domestic dispute. So there are crimes that are in question. There were, some of these cases were still open, like the arrest happened days before they were taken to Alligator Alcatraz. There was a CBS report that showed that there was someone with assault charges, but without like really a full scope, right, of
Right.
each of these 400 people, 300 people have done, it's really unclear to show a really good
Right.
analysis of what their criminal looked.
And speaking of that CBS4 report of yours, Ivan, you spoke with Leamsi Izquierdo, a Cuban reggaeton singer who's now detained at Alligator Alcatraz. He's a legal U.S. resident, correct? But he's in there because he apparently was arrested for assault in a recent dispute with a tow truck driver. But what did he tell you, though, about what things are like inside the detention center?
Hi, Tim. Thank you for the space. Yes, I spoke to Izquierdo, and I also talked to his fiancée, Katia Hernandez. Basically, one of the many things he's alleging, he's saying that the condition of the food is terrible. He dared to say that they have like worms. He becomes very graphic to the size of the mosquitoes that they're exposed. He even go as far as saying that they could be the size of an elephant. That the AC breaks frequently, and that one of the things that he and the girlfriend address that they did not have toothbrush or toothpaste since they arrived, and in his case was Friday, a week ago, and that he had not been allowed to take showers.
Right.
Now, for the sake of all these things, we have to be fair. So,
Right.
the entity that is in charge of all this is the Florida Division of Emergency Management. So I wrote to the Director of Communications. Her name is Stephanie Hartman, and her response was, quote, "All those allegations from the violent criminal detainee you cite are untrue. The facility meets all state and federal obligations for detentions," end quote.
Okay, good. No, thanks for that state response, Yvonne. But Izquierdo also told you that he's concerned about whether he'll receive due process of law inside Alligator Alcatraz. Now, we know that component of what Attorney General Uthmeyer says the facility is designed for, not just detention, but case processing, and then the actual deportations themselves embarking from the airstrip there has not been set up yet. So, Yvonne, are you hearing concerns from people like other people, aside from Izquierdo, that due process might not materialize at this facility?
I've heard it from Izquierdo, and I also heard it from the wife of another Cuban detainee. I've been in contact with that family also. They tell me that in the case of this other Cuban man who has been in the US for 19 years, he was pulled over for driving with a suspended license.
Yeah.
The wife tells me that he is not a US resident. She believes that he never handled the whole situation. But at this point, she fears that he's not going to have due process. Now, the common denominator among these two men is that they, or their relatives also, saying that they have not been allowed to be in contact with their immigration attorney.
Attorneys, right. Okay.
In the case specifically about Izquierdo, he made some serious allegations. I'm trying to confirm that with the attorney. Izquierdo alleges that his immigration attorney looks him up on the list, and it's like they don't appear as if they're at Alligator Alcatraz, as if they were
Right.
there. Evidently, you know what's the official response that we're getting from local authorities, that everything is untrue, everything is false, and they even dare to say that they're criminals.
But
I'm
suspect,
waiting for the from the attorney to from this.
But suspended license. Ana Ceballos, that brings us to another case the Herald reported this week about a DACA recipient, or what people known as Dreamers, as undocumented migrants who were brought here as young children, and so they are shielded from deportation. A Dreamer was detained apparently after a traffic stop and put in alligator Alcatraz. What, Ana, can you tell us about that case and what it seems to be telling us about how the facility is being used?
Right, we heard that anecdote through his the DACA recipient's attorney. His name is Philip Arroyo, and he said that his client had been, arrested for what he described as a misunderstanding during a traffic stop. He said that he was stopped because he was driving without a license, but that he actually did have a valid driver's license at the time of the traffic stop, and that prosecutors were intending to reduce the misdemeanor to a civil citation.
Okay.
But by the time that he was detained, he had already made its way. He had landed in alligator Alcatraz.
So, Anna, given all this that we've just been talking about, I want to shift here a little to a bit of what Mayor Levine Cava's Herald op-ed in audio form said.
We're seeing overpopulated detention centers right here in our community where immigrants, the vast majority of them people who have committed no violent crimes, are kept in unsafe conditions. That's why I called on the state to give the county monitoring access to Alligator Alcatraz.
So, Anna, she also points out that Miami-Dade County owns that parcel of Everglades land that Alligator Alcatraz is built on, and that Governor DeSantis took possession of it under the state illegal immigration emergency he declared a couple years ago. But public information about this facility has become a big issue. So, does the mayor have a case that Miami-Dade County should at least have monitoring access to the site?
I mean, that is, I guess, up to the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, that's what she's trying to argue here, that that's something that she should have access to, considering that her county has jurisdiction over certain aspects of this piece of land. That she did request weekly state reports on the conditions of the facility as well, but it doesn't seem like the state has really responded in any approving way yet, as of yet. And so it's just, again, it's kind of hanging in the eye of the beholder. There is kind of the threat that if she were to just continue to challenge perhaps this piece of what's going on in the county property, that there is options to potentially remove her from office. Like, there's all sorts of things that the governor could potentially use using his emergency powers and other executive powers.
And yesterday we saw Democratic state legislators sue Governor DeSantis to be allowed unannounced visits to the facility, which they insist they're permitted to make under state law. What's the state argument for not allowing their unannounced visits?
So the state has said that, that the reason why the statute, that the lawmakers do not have the legal authority to enter this facility is because it is not deemed a quote-unquote correctional facility under statute, which would be the thing that governs the right for lawmakers to visit these sites at their pleasure. They're not really disclosing or explaining what they believe this facility would fall under statutory definition, but they have also called the lawsuit ridiculous because, on Saturday they have invited state legislators and members of Congress to visit the site during a scheduled tour.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Ana Ceballos and CBS4 Miami's Yvonne Taylor about the controversy surrounding the new Alligator Alcatraz Migrant Detention Center out in the Everglades and what its first detainees are telling us about it. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Yvonne Taylor, we've also seen protests against Alligator Alcatraz in the form of highway billboards here in Miami-Dade County, put up by activist groups like the Florida Immigrant Coalition. The immigrant community is obviously a core part of our population here, and I know you cover it quite extensively. So, Yvonne, what's your sense of the general public feeling about this unusual detention center?
I'm going to get to that question right now, Tim. But before that, I want to add to what Anna just stated, which I thought it was interesting. During my last conversation with Izquierdo, and I asked him, I said, have you approached the ICE agents looking out for you? And then his words was, they're not ICE agents. In fact, they tell us that we're not inmates. We are guests. And I said, well, how are they dressed? I mean, how do you know what's the difference? And he tells me they're wearing gray shirts. And it says officer, but they are seemingly privately hired.
Okay.
And they tell them that they have very limited knowledge of each of their cases. They're there to overlook for them so that there are no confrontations or anything like that. Okay. And I think that adds up to what Anna just said when she stated the whole thing, that is not considered a correctional facility.
Interesting.
Now, going back to what you asked me.
Yeah.
So the Florida Immigrant Coalition, indeed, they're the ones who established these billboards. I dare to say that they're the ones that have been the most forefront in this whole thing of asking specifically the mayor and county officials to take action in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. What I'm getting that it's interesting, I mean, as those of us who cover immigration, we've seen little by little an increase in fear by those that are directly affected. But now I'm perceiving it even among the immigration activists. Some of them, they're not as outspoken as they used to be. No question, they are outraged. That's probably the best way to describe it. They're outraged. Mm-hmm. They address the environmental harm that the center is creating.
Yeah.
And many of them are telling me that we have ample and plenty of problems that that should be addressed here instead of opening a detention center in which many of the people that are that go there are not criminals.
Right.
But the fear, without a doubt, it's spreading and it's growing.
Anna Ceballos, I want to ask you about that community feeling as well. I mean, whether it's Republican or Democrat, immigrant or non-immigrant, responding not just to Alligator Alcatraz as a detention facility, but as a sort of performative symbol of the severe migrant deportation campaign President Trump and state leaders like Governor DeSantis are pursuing. In her Herald op-ed this week, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levy-Cava said Alligator Alcatraz, quote, is not who we are. What do you think she meant by that, especially since we hear a lot lately about how the whole concept behind the facility carries certain racist overtones as well, no? At least regarding migrants.
Well, I can't really speak for the mayor, but what I can say is that I think there's been a lot of concern, at least from members of her own party, right? She's a Democrat, about like the humanitarian approach to this whole facility. And by all means, we have seen, right, President Donald Trump, Florida Attorney General James Othmeyer, even the governor, Ron DeSantis, have really messaged pretty strongly on this facility as a way that could serve potentially as a deterrent for immigrants. And a lot of that has effectively been by using, you know, pretty imagery that can be upsetting to a lot of people. Imagery that, you know, suggests that, you know, if a detainee escapes, maybe an alligator will be hunting them down. That is a scary thought for any migrant who might be afraid that, you know, state, local, or federal law enforcement might be out to get them.
Yeah.
And whether, you know, it's not necessarily at this point, I mean, obviously it's a debate over immigration and how to deal with illegal immigration. But at this point, I think the debate is starting to center more, from Democrats at least, on how you treat a human when you're trying to uphold the law.
And I should note, Miami's Roman Catholic Archbishop Thomas Zwinski also weighed in this morning, calling Alligator Alcatraz, quote, corrosive of the common good. But to end things here, in response to those humanitarian concerns, Florida Republicans like House Speaker Daniel Perez, himself a Miami-Dade County resident, made the argument to Local 10's Glenna Milberg this week that a detention facility is not supposed to be a, quote, resort.
I went and I saw this place in person. Look, it's no five-star resort, but the standards are definitely higher than any federal, state, or local facility. I mean, that is without a doubt. We're holding criminals in these locations. It could not be a five-star resort.
Yvonne Taylor, just in the 30 seconds we have left, how do you respond to that assertion that the speaker is making there?
I think it's absurd to say that, you know, you can't compare it with a five-star hotel, because they're detained, and we're learning more and more that these people are not necessarily all of them criminals. I mean, I understand that if somebody did commit a crime, but we're finding out about more and more that they committed what, infractions, that they'd be misdemeanors. And it sounds more like meeting a quota more than anything.
Okay.
Before I say goodbye, I just want to add, when I asked the mayor what worried her the most about Alligator Alcatraz, she said, we are spending money on things that are really not productive. We need to find pathways for those who are here contributing to our society.
Yvonne, I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it there for time. I apologize. Yvonne Taylor is a reporter at CBS4 Miami. Ana Ceballos is politics and policy reporter at the Miami Herald. Many thanks to you both. Still to come, would the U.S. really send 500,000 Haitians back to the gang horror in Haiti? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. As this week began, we here in Miami heard reports that one of Haiti's most iconic landmarks, the beautiful Olufsen Hotel in Port-au-Prince, had been burned down over the weekend by the violent criminal gangs that all but rule the country now. It was just the latest outrage on top of all the other horrible atrocities the gangs commit in Haiti. And on this side of the Caribbean, it only heightened this question. How in the world could the Trump administration believe it's safe for Haitians here to return there? But that's precisely what President Trump is pushing for as he seeks to terminate the temporary protected status, or TPS, that has shielded 500,000 Haitians in this country from deportation. Haitians aren't the only migrant community facing this. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans stand to lose their TPS, and this week more than 76,000 Hondurans and Nicaraguans learned they do too. The bigger question, of course, is why can't Congress come up with immigration reform to address these situations? Joining me now in the studio to examine this crisis is Franly Julien, a respected Haitian-American immigration attorney in North Miami. Franly, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tim. I'm glad to be here, and thank you for the nice introduction.
We want to hear your thoughts as well out there. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Franly, I just want to start by reminding our listeners why more than 500,000 Haitians here who were granted temporary protected status, or TPS, in the first place, and why it's been renewed and extended over the years. Can you briefly walk us through that?
Absolutely, Tim. Haiti was first granted TPS in 2010, shortly after the earthquake. It was a major earthquake which created a major humanitarian crisis from which Haiti is still recovering. Right. Now, a little bit later, Haiti's president, before that there was an earthquake in the south, and Haiti was redesignated for TPS. Then we had the assassination of President Moïse
in 2021. Right.
Haiti was redesignated.
Right. So you've got the political crisis on top of the natural disaster, and that's what has created the necessity for TPS over these past 15 years. So the Trump administration is now trying to cancel Haitian TPS, and I should say, not just terminate it, but terminate it before it's actually supposed to expire, right?
Yes, because per the last redesignation by the Biden administration, TPS is supposed to end on February 2nd, 2026.
Right.
What happened with the Trump administration, they issued a notice to shorten it initially to August 3rd, and then finally, they wanted it to end. They still wanted to end on September 3rd.
Right.
Now, the problem with that, Tim, is that Haiti today is in worse shape than it has ever been at any previous designation or redesignation period.
Right, and I want to get to that, and I just want to ask you quickly, though, what is the Trump administration's reasoning for this, for canceling TPS for Haitians even before it expires? Or, should I say, what is the reason they're stating in public, and what's the real reason most people see behind this in terms of increasing the pool of migrants the administration can deport?
Absolutely. So here it is. Officially, the administration is stating that the situation in Haiti has improved to such an extent that they can end TPS. But right before that, the administration, when they decided to impose a total travel ban on Haiti, in the body of the executive order, it is stated that Haiti has no central authority today.
Right.
So this is the same administration. So what's actually happening is that President Trump had promised to deport illegal immigrants. Those on TPS are legal immigrants. Right. So what the administration is doing to widen the pool of illegal immigrants so that they can deport them, they are stripping them of their protection so that they can widen the pool and deport them.
And they
them.
Become deportable, right.
Yes.
But Franley, when we look at the gang terror reality on the ground now in Haiti, and mm-hmm. let's remind people, the Trump administration has even designated the gangs an international terrorist entity. Is there any conceivable way that the Trump administration can make a case that it's safe to send 500,000 people back into that country? Help us understand why you and so many other Haitian migrant advocates say it would be a cruelty, essentially, to do that.
It would be a death sentence for the majority of these people. I think we need to take into account several factors. One factor is the fact that most of these people have been living in the United States for 15, 20, right. 25 years. Mm-hmm. They have built lives in the United States. And I have in mind one of my clients. She came to the United States in 1993. She's been working minimum wage since then, but she has purchased two homes. She is keeping up with the mortgage payments, and she has two U.S. citizen children. So when you have those mixed status families, you're asking yourself, what's going to happen? Are we sending the mother to Haiti while the kids, U.S. citizen kids, remain in the United States? Or will they have to make the difficult decision of taking the kids to Haiti where they will likely be killed?
Yeah.
And those people will be walking targets because the assumption by the gangs will be, they have come with money.
They have resources.
They
right?
have resources. Yeah. We're going to kidnap, rape, and kill them.
They're an affluent target.
Yes.
Now, as we mentioned, a federal judge has ruled that the Trump administration cannot accelerate the TPS expiration date from next February to next month. But what actions are we seeing in federal court right now to prevent the administration from letting Haitian TPS expire in the first place? Are there any legal avenues for the Haitian community at this point to keep TPS alive and extended until it actually is safe for people to return to Haiti?
Right now, the latest development in the court is the judge's decision. Now, after the judge's decision, I was expecting the government to update the USCIS's website. Mm-hmm. This has not been done. But I know, for having followed the case closely, I know that the judge is going to get back to the government and ask them to do so.
USCIS being U.S. Customs and Immigration Services.
Absolutely.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with North Miami immigration attorney Franley Julien about the temporary protected status crisis facing Haitians and other migrant communities here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Franley, what are your Haitian clients, like the woman you just mentioned, telling you about how they're coping with this uncertainty? I know one thing many Haitian TPS holders are trying to do now is upgrade their immigration status to something more permanent like asylum, but even asylum opportunities are now being heavily restricted by the Trump administration. I myself spoke with a Haitian TPS holder this week who said he's thinking of just going underground because he can't go back to his neighborhood in Port-au-Prince that a gang now controls that had threatened to kill him. How are they coping with this?
We are seeing a lot of anxiety. And there is this distorted view in American society that those who are on TPS are not contributing to American society. And Tim, I can tell, and you know,
well,
I know.
Well, the woman you just mentioned, I imagine she's a tax-paying, gainfully employed.
but let me tell you something. If you go to the healthcare sector, for example, mm-hmm. One thing that is not mentioned often enough is that we have a lot of Haitian professionals who are working as HHAs and CNAs.
HHA being home health aides. Right, home health
and aid. Certified nursing assistants, mm-hmm. who were physicians in Haiti.
Right.
So those are people who are working 2-3 jobs, but they're still underemployed because they're performing at a level lower than the skills they are contributing, while receiving salaries that are way beneath the skills they are contributing. Yeah. This is a clear advantage for American society because those physicians who are working as HHS and CNAs are saving lives at a level that actual CNAs and HHA could not have done.
Right, and healthcare is definitely a sector where demand for personnel is very high in this country. Now, of course, it's not just Haitians who are facing this crisis. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans and now tens of thousands of Hondurans and Nicaraguans here are being told their TPS benefit is being terminated. A new federal lawsuit was filed this week in California challenging the Trump administration's attempt to cancel TPS for all these groups. One Nicaraguan migrant from Miami, Maria Hernandez, is a plaintiff in that suit. And TPS holders like her, of course, can make an argument that sending them back to the very brutal dictatorship in Nicaragua would also be cruel, as would sending folks back to Venezuela's very brutal dictatorship be. Does, though, Franley, this litigation stand a chance?
I doubt it, Tim, and I'm going to tell you why. Immigration is considered foreign policy in the United States. And per the U.S. Supreme Court's jurisprudence, they don't want the courts to get in the way of the federal government, particularly the president, when he's acting under international scene. So it is unfortunate that we have to resort to litigation for issues that are so obvious. We should be able to appeal to human decency. And I was hearing you earlier speaking about alligator Alcatraz.
Right.
This is a monument to our loss of decency, of humanity, the tendency to impose unnecessary evil. Even so, we have reached a point where even when the government is acting right, is doing it wrong.
Right.
You see what I mean? So,
but again, the state would argue, well, these are, you know, we've arrested criminal undocumented migrants, and this is just how criminals should be treated in a detention facility.
Yeah, but when you go to alligator Alcatraz, although I disagree that even criminals should be treated like this by the state, because mm-hmm. the state should be better than the criminals. But you're going to find a lot of people who are not criminals who are currently at alligator Alcatraz.
Right. But Franley, this brings us to another important aspect of this crisis in the bigger picture. Is everything perhaps that we're dealing with now a reflection of how poorly thought out Congress's original temporary protected status legislation was back in 1990? On the one hand, as a U.S. humanitarian gesture, it's undoubtedly admirable. But on the other hand, it feels as though Congress didn't do a very good job back then thinking ahead to what happens if TPS groups like Haitians find themselves remaining in the U.S., not just for a few years, but maybe for a few decades. What is the fix to this solution, in your opinion, as an immigration expert?
The law should be that every 18 months, there's a reevaluation of the situation on the respective countries.
But isn't that the law now?
We see TPS renewed
every 18 months.
No, absolutely. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, I agree with the fact that there should be an evaluation every 18 months. Mm-hmm. And then, to me, the law to make sense, TPS law to make sense, should be that after a certain number of renewals, there should be a permanent fix mm-hmm. for these people.
As in, okay, we've come to a point where we just need to put these people on a path to legal residency.
Absolutely, because mm-hmm. they have contributed so much.
Right, and they're so embedded in the community.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm going to give you an example. Mm-hmm. If someone right now who's been in the United States since 2010, mm-hmm. if they're adjusting their status today, they do not need an affidavit of support. because you can just print out this social security statement to show that they have worked enough, they have contributed enough to American society that they do not need a sponsor to adjust status. Right. So how can we, on the other hand, say that these people who normally don't need a sponsor, we can send them back despite their contribution to society? It doesn't make any sense.
Right. So again, another call for immigration reform from our Congress. Franly Julien is an immigration attorney in North Miami. Franly, many thanks.
Oh man, I'm the one to thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing. You're a credible voice in this community. We are so grateful to you.
Well, we appreciate that, Franly. Thank you very much and best of luck.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, Key West defies, then obeys Governor DeSantis on immigration enforcement. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. As we've mentioned on this show in recent weeks, there is a very important lawsuit being heard up in Leon County, filed by the city of South Miami, to determine whether Florida can compel local governments to take part in federal immigration enforcement. But until a ruling comes out of that case, local governments across the state are wrestling with whether to defy Governor Ron DeSantis on this question or surrender to his threats to punish them, financially or otherwise, if they don't get on board. The most recent locality caught up in that drama is Key West. Few Florida cities prize their independence more than the so-called Conch Republic, so it was little surprise last week when Key West voted to opt out of what's known as a 287G agreement to partner with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, or ICE. But this week, Key West suddenly reversed that decision and opted back in with the feds. Joining me now to explore why is Heather Slifko-Bathurst. She's co-founder of the nonprofit Key West Immigrant Support Network. Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you're a conch or would just like to share your thoughts about Key West's vote this week, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Heather, before we discuss this week's Key West vote on cooperating with federal immigration enforcement, I want to give our listeners a sense of last week's vote when Key West said it would not partner with ICE under a 287G agreement. And it sounds like they pulled out last week because they felt that Key West Police Chief Sean Brandenburg had originally signed on with the feds in a rather unkosher way. Can you walk us through what happened last week and why?
Sure. So inevitably, what was voted on and passed as a resolution at that commission meeting on the 30th was essentially them identifying an administrative error that the Key West chief of police did not have the authority based on city charter to sign on to that agreement. It essentially needed to either have been the city manager himself or the chief of police could have signed on to it if he had been directed by the commission to do so.
Right.
So the 287G agreement that was signed was essentially deemed null and void. And therefore, you know, the argument is that we were never in one to begin with.
Okay. So in just a matter of days, Key West commissioners reconsider that vote, and then they vote this week, 4-2, to reverse themselves and, in fact, enter into a 287G agreement with federal immigration enforcement. Again, walk us through, Heather, what you think happened this week and why, I guess I would imagine a letter from Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer threatening to remove Key West commissioners from office probably had a lot to do with it.
Sure, I would say that probably played a quite a large role, but we also have it on record, the mayor herself coming on the radio and saying it was never her intention to stay out of the 287G agreement. The reason she voted the way she did on the 30th, according to her, is that she wanted to do it the right way, and so they had to overturn that first agreement before they could enter into a new one, and according to the mayor, that is how she intended to vote the entire time.
Okay, well, let's listen.
She did not disclose that to us, however, at the June 30th meeting.
Well, let's listen actually to the mayor and to another Key West commissioner who, like her, flipped their votes from nay to yay on cooperation with federal immigration enforcement. First Commissioner and Key West Mayor Denise Enriquez.
Tonight, I had to vote in support of signing the 287G to give our chief of police the authority to assist, not to go out there and to raid. It's to go out there and to assist ICE.
And here's what Key West Commissioner and former police chief Donald Lee had to say.
During my tenure as a police officer, there were times that I didn't agree with the law, but had to enforce it. This appears to be one of them today. I hope that the pending declaratory relief action filed by the City of Miami soon provides answers to municipalities' legal requirements on this issue. Until that time, I believe we must follow the law and require the Key West Police Department to enter into the 287G agreement. So tonight, I will vote with my head and not my heart.
Now, I should note we did reach out to Key West officials like Mayor Enriquez and Commissioner Lee, but they did not reply to our invitation to join this discussion. But Heather, as we can sort of hear there at the end of Donald Lee's remarks, this decision was not popular with most Key West residents. Why?
Well, I think what you heard in that clip was, you know, we were very much looking to Donnie Lee. He was essentially going to dictate to us how the vote was going to go. And so that conversation, you know, that statement that he made before the voting even took place was indicative of how the rest of the meeting was going to go and the community responding to that. It was frustrating for many of us because of the overwhelming amount of legal evidence that we provided them that that indicated that we were very much standing on legal ground to stay out of the 287G agreement. We had several major legal organizations offering pro bono support, including the ACLU standing behind Key West in their decision that they made on June 30th. Javier Fernandez, the South Florida mayor, wrote a letter in support of Key West based on those legal standings. And so I think that was the root of much of that frustration is that, you know, they had us, you know, 2.5 hours of community support for staying out of 287G, for Donnie Lee to come in with a pre-written statement that he did not defer from after listening to the community support to stay out of the 287G agreement was just really a slap in the face,
right.
I think.
And I want to get to those legal aspects of this dispute that we're going to discuss here. First, I just want to say this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Heather Slifko-Bathurst of the Key West Immigrant Support Network about the city's sudden about-face this week to help the feds with immigration enforcement. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, again, going back to the legal matter here, Heather, obviously, South Miami, for example, is arguing that state law may say that it wants local governments to cooperate with the feds on immigration enforcement, but the statute doesn't actually say they have to. Is that what you were essentially arguing yourselves down in Key West to your commissioners there?
Correct, yes. And in fact, that was brought to the Florida legislature by Ron DeSantis himself, I believe in July of last year. I'm not 100% sure of that date. I wasn't able to find it prior to this interview, but it was presented to the Florida legislature. Ron DeSantis did ask for permission to make it mandatory for municipalities to have to enter into agreements like this 287G. And the Florida legislature vehemently said no.
Right. So again, there's a law out there that says we really want local governments to do this, but technically the law does not say they have to. So Heather, as I mentioned at the outset, there is a suit being heard, filed by the city of South Miami up here in Miami-Dade County, that challenges the state of Florida's, or at least Governor Ron DeSantis's assertion that local governments are compelled under that state law to join 287G agreements and cooperate, if not partner with, federal immigration enforcement. Here's a big question that we have here, though. If cities like Key West feel strongly about not being ordered to join arrangements like this, why don't they themselves join this lawsuit as co-plaintiffs with South Miami?
Well, unfortunately, I think given the way that this meeting on Tuesday went, it's evident to me that the community members of Key West feel one way and our conservative commission feels another. And so obviously we have a bit of a rift in terms of politics. And so there has been a lot of discussion about what that means for upcoming elections.
Right. And there was some discussion about whether Key West should hold off on its vote this week to opt back into the 287G agreement until a ruling in that South Miami suit comes out. Why did the Key West Commission in the end decide not to wait for a ruling in this case, do you think?
Again, I think it comes down to politics. I think there are some people that are sitting on that commission dais that believe that we should be policing and rounding up our immigrant community. And I think for others, they were acting out of fear. That letter from Uth Meyer, I'm not going to, you know, not going to deny the fact that that letter was incredibly powerful. And, you know, apparently the legal case that we made against it was just not strong enough.
Now, Heather, as a co-founder of a nonprofit like the Key West Immigrant Support Network, can you tell us what sort of undocumented migrant presence is in the community there, not just in Key West, but in the Keys and Monroe County in general? And what's their economic footprint there, for example?
Sure. And I just want to be very clear. Our immigrant community here is nearly fully documented. I work very closely with dozens of community members who are part of this thing going on right now. And I have not met a single one that is quote unquote undocumented. Now, that being said, when they continuously move the goalpost and sunset programs like Nicaraguan and Haitian TPS, obviously people are moving into categories they haven't existed in prior to. But because Florida is a red state, because it is a conservative state, because for the last several years, Ron DeSantis has made it so difficult to hire undocumented immigrants, it's very unusual, especially given how much it costs to live down here. It's very unusual to come across quote unquote undocumented immigrants. Most of the people that I know who are very scared right now have full-time jobs with companies that sponsor their work authorization. They carry around Social Security numbers administered by the U.S. Department of State. They carry around Florida driver's licenses. They carry around U.S. government cards. And we have seen time and time again, ICE and those agencies that are assisting ICE, regardless of all of that paperwork, take and detain people.
Right. Is there also a concern there that we've seen in so many other cities, like here, like Coral Gables and Hialeah, for example, in Miami-Dade County, a concern that if you do sign up with these 287G agreements, you are really risking a plunge in the cooperation between the local community and the police when it comes to things like reporting crimes?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that was one of the major arguments made. You know, one of the other things that our organization that has come to the attention of our organization this week is a question about how many of the officers and which of the officers in the QSPD is going to be deputized. Specifically, we're concerned with the SROs in schools and whether or not they will be deputized and what that means for our immigrant community who is going to be returning back to schools in August.
SROs meaning the resource officers, the police who are assigned to schools.
Correct. And we have, you know, we've been talking with some of the school administrators. They're already preparing to create an online program similar to what we had during COVID, because right, they know that many of their students will not be returning because their parents okay. will be too afraid to send them.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Heather Slifko-Bathurst is co-founder of the nonprofit Key West Immigrant Support Network. Heather, many thanks. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim. Have a great day.
You too. Finally on the roundup, we heard this week that Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport will be among the first in the nation where passengers can now go through security without having to take off their shoes. But just as we were celebrating that bit of relief from air travel aggravation, this from Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood took us right back to reality.
Right now, what? Shut your mouth.
I'm going to wait for the people in front of me to get up. That's how we do it.
My God, you're all whiny for no reason.
Where are you going? Let the the people go.
Wow.
That's from a video that went really viral this week. It captures folks inside an arriving JetBlue flight at Fort Lauderdale Hollywood, calling out a woman who was cutting in front of other passengers trying to disembark. She seems to rebuke them for not realizing just how much more important she is. It's something you see more and more of after you land these days. But these passengers said, enough. Letting people in rows ahead of you leave first is the sort of courtesy we supposedly learn in kindergarten. But here's the rich part. The woman said she needed to get off first because she was a lawyer. Lady, the only thing worse than that would be me telling people I should be allowed to cut in line because I'm a journalist. It ain't gonna fly. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.